It's a real pleasure. Let me begin by saying it's a real pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Moshe and the organizing committee for selecting my paper. It's a real pleasure in part, not only because of the nature of the outstanding audience that we have today, and also in part because of the theme of the center on personal risk management. And if anybody looks real carefully at my own resume, even though my papers seem to be in all sorts of disparate areas, in fact, actually probably more than half the papers actually deal directly with issues of personal financial management. And so it's a real pleasure to be here. It's also a real pleasure to be following Jim, as Jim alluded to several times during his talk. The methods that I've been pursuing in my work with Bob Damon and Harold Zhang are potentially quite applicable to this question of shadow values and implicit value associated with differential bases. And I think our discussion and conversation this morning, I found really thought provoking. And I think you'll sort of see in the work that I'm going to present sort of a methodology that potentially speaks to some of the issues that we're talking about, but where our focus has not been, frankly, to really tease out and detail those interpretations, potentiality, though I think we're doing that down the road. Let me also say that while my web page isn't fancy, I have been relatively systematic in the last few years in trying to update my web page with respect to electronic copies of my papers, even the published papers, when we have the appropriate copyright clearances. And it turns out, actually, in the tax area, all of my tax-related papers, in fact, including the published ones, can actually be downloaded directly from my web page. The link is here. Also, I think I put in the note in the conference notebook our paper rather than the presentation slides. But I understand that the presentation slides also will be available through the conference website. In any case, if you have difficulty accessing that either through the or accessing any of the papers, you're certainly welcomed and encouraged to contact me directly. Okay, so the fundamental question that I want to try to get at today is the question of what should investors put in their taxable accounts and their tax deferred accounts? What do you want to locate where? And while our paper, as a point of historical thought, our paper was motivated by the tax code in the United States. I'm pleased to report that based upon what I learned both at dinner last night and also through this morning's session, that while some of the details of the assumptions that we make need to sort of minor alteration to reflect the Canadian context, the broad messages of the work really go through completely in sort of ways that I'll try to make clear. Indeed, the modifications that are needed to deal with the Canadian issues are quite modest, as we'll see. So the broad issue that I want to pose is basically, I think of it as a normative question. How should investors actually allocate their asset holdings in both taxable and tax-deferred accounts? And let me say sort of at the onset that basically investors get this point wrong. I mean, they flat out get this wrong. And to sort of illustrate this, sometimes when I do these talks, I do a little survey, and I ask the participants, if you think about what proportion of your tax-deferred account is in equity, and what proportion of your taxable account is in equity, which is higher? Within your tax-deferred account, do you have relatively more equity, or do you have relatively more equity in your taxable account? So I thought maybe I could start my presentation by taking a little show of hands. And what I'd like people to do is to raise their hand if they have a higher fraction of their tax-deferred wealth in equity, So let's say if in your pension accounts, if 70% of that is equity, and in your personal accounts, 40% is equity, then you would have relatively more of your tax-deferred wealth in equity than your taxable. So how many of you would be in that category? Where relatively more of your tax-deferred account is equity. So you're sort of basically taking the view, I'm investing for the long term in my tax-deferred account, so that's where I'm going to put my long-term investment equity. Let me just sort of get, if I can just get a quick show of hands. Okay, how many of you would say you have relatively more of your taxable account in equity? So this is actually split about 50-50. This is the most impressive set of responses that I've ever achieved. I'm not sure if I've actually done this in finance presentations, but I've done it. I did this when I presented this work at the Caltech Economics Department. A bunch of very distinguished economists, half a dozen or so fellows of the Econometric Society, some really world-class people. And the only person in the audience who indicated that they follow this, as sort of about half of you did, put in their tax-deferred account less equity than in their taxable account, was a person who's a more recently a collaborator of mine in a different context, and who had also been a collaborator of one of my co-authors, and who had already read our paper and understood the message quite cleanly, and told me he had adjusted appropriately prior to my presentation. I did an analogous talk at the Courant Institute. It's a little bit sort of somewhat analogous to the Fields Institute in its orientation at NYU, to the math group there. And basically, I think there was I think one person who said, well, he wasn't sure, and he kind of told me his litany of measurement issues about what the question meant. And I think other than that, maybe out of 15 respondents, almost everybody was in the wrong direction. So what's the message really the message from our work is that equity is really valuable in the taxable account. Bonds really valuable in the tax deferred account, and we'll sort of tease this out. So the question basically is, how should investors allocate their holding in both taxable and tax deferred accounts? Of course, in the taxable account, there's also tax timing options due to the opportunity to realize losses. Versus in the retirement account, you simply earn the pre-tax returns. Ultimately, you do pay tax on retirement investing, both in Canada and the United States, but the tax is based upon withdrawals, and it's not really keyed to the composition of investment return. And we want to try to understand upon what do these optimal holdings in the taxable and tax-deferred accounts depend? How valuable is it for the investor to locate his asset holdings efficiently? What's the relative value of having tax-deferred wealth versus taxable wealth, and what does it depend? So these are some of the kind of questions that we want to try to address. Also, we want to address, to what extent do liquidity, so probably the main, when people sort of push back, let's say in the context of the survey or another context, and they say, well, we're not really capturing the essence of the problem, the main substantive objection that people point to is the issue of liquidity. So basically, and the way I think of that within the context of our framework, is that the problem is the following, that you may have needs for financial wealth long before your retirement years and long before you can, on a penalty-free basis, access your tax-deferred account. And so then the question is, if there's sort of costs associated with accessing your tax-deferred account, to what extent might you want to hedge within your taxable account to help meet some of your interim needs? And it is true that one can construct scenarios where, in fact, it may make sense to hold some bonds in the taxable account or hold more bonds in the taxable account for those hedging reasons, but I want to argue through a numerical example that, in fact, I think a lot of that incentive is overstated. And really the issue of liquidity creating demand for equity in the taxable account, I think is really mostly motivated by basically this issue of not being able to access the tax-deferred account. And so, for example, I had a conversation with one of my colleagues a few months ago who's in his mid-50s. Well, in the United States, you can access these tax-deferred accounts if you're 59 and a half. So when I was asking him about his locational patents, and then he kind of got very apologetic, but then he immediately came back reasonably visible macroeconomist, this fellow, he came back with the focus upon, well, you know, what you know, he might need the money. So I said, well, you know, keep in mind that if you you can always access your retirement funds, and you know, basically you're going to be able to access them in a few years, penalty free. And the issue then basically is, do you see that there's significant risk that you're going to run out of those of the taxable funds before you can access the tax-deferred account? And when I sort of posed it that way, I think he kind of understood, well, maybe liquidity isn't that much of an issue. So I think whether liquidity is an issue really depends upon one's context. So the detailed framework that I'm going to use for my numerical analysis will really build upon an earlier paper of ours that was published in the Review of Financial Studies last year. And what that paper basically did is it basically set up a model for looking at the trade-off between rebalancing and paying capital gains taxes. Investors would like to rebalance their portfolios, but the problem is rebalancing is costly, because if you've got appreciated positions, you've got to then pay the capital gains tax to rebalance. So we try to characterize a number of aspects of that trade-off with a model in which the realization decisions are endogenous, and we sort of solve for the optimal portfolio policy, solving backwards using dynamic programming. But taking into it the reason that it's fundamentally a dynamic problem is because whether you realize the position today influences then obviously what your future tax basis is going to be. And by using a dynamic formulation, we're going to be able to capture that fundamental dynamic that also Jim spoke about in his talk earlier today, because obviously the tax basis is really central to some of these trade-offs. By the way, in our work, also just coincidentally, one of the things it does is also within our work, an important aspect of some of our qualitative features of the solution is driven by the reset provision of death in the United States, where your basis, if you hold on to the positions till death, as Jim described this morning, your basis gets reset to the full market value and the capital gains tax gets eliminated. So one of the benchmarks, in fact, that we explicitly incorporated in our paper was a benchmark of the Canadian law, where, in fact, at death, you pay capital gains taxes at that point on the full appreciation. And actually, in the portfolio policies that emerged were, in fact, qualitatively different, because some of the age dependencies that we were able to document having to do with the role of the reset at death essentially got eliminated under the Canadian system, and that was sort of an interesting feature of our analysis. And so even though that was done without a Canadian audience in mind, in fact, it highlighted quite explicitly, I think, an important feature of the Canadian law. So some of the kind of features that, and these will be the features that underlie sort of our numerical solution. Well, the model and the, in particular, the numerical solutions, based upon the following sort of framework. We have an investor who makes annual consumption and portfolio decisions starting at age 20. We use mortality calibrated to that of the U.S. population. The mortality, of course, is increasing with age. We use about a 20-year-old mortality schedule. So under our mortality schedule, basically the investors didn't live past 100. Now, some folks in the insurance industry, in particular TIA CREP, passed along to me a mortality table that they said was sort of reflective of all purchases of annuities. By the way, not their purchases of annuities, who I believe actually have even more favorable mortality than the overall purchases, but they gave me a mortality table based upon the overall purchases. And I must say I was really struck by this mortality table, because in fact the conditional probability of death didn't reach 50% until the investor was 114. I must say I wouldn't have quite introspected along those lines. But anyway, we're not using that mortality table. We're using one that was about 20 years. It's actually not a very favorable table. It's about 20 years old, and it was reflective of the whole U.S. population. We have stochastic labor income in our framework. We assume constant relative risk aversion. We use a risk aversion coefficient of 3, which is sort of pretty typical of what people like to use in these sort of studies. We assume an annual subjective discount factor of 0.96, so we're discounting subjective utility about 4% a year. And we have a bequest motive, and the way we parameterize it basically is that at death, the investor's total wealth is invested in an annuity that provides consumption support for his beneficiary for age periods, and we take age to be 20. Here, to kind of keep things a bit simple, instead of having the next generation start over with a problem that's like ours, instead we just put them in riskless bonds so we don't worry about these tax issues from the point of view of the next generation, so then we're just able to get a kind of a certainty equivalent once this investor dies. The investment opportunity set is one with basically constant opportunities over time on a pre-tax basis. We have constant risk-free return and a risky stock with constant dividend yield and stochastic but constant distribution for the underlying binomial return. Now, how do taxes work? The dividend and the tax details are motivated by the U.S. law, and I'll sort of just comment briefly upon the differences with Canada. So we tax dividend and interest is received. Within our setup, we actually took the tax rates on those to be the same. I understand here that that interest income is taxed at a higher rate than dividends. That doesn't affect the message. Remember, the message is equity is disadvantageous, is attractive in the taxable account. Well, if you pay a higher tax rate on bond income than on equity dividends, that reinforces that point. We tax capital gains and losses at sale, as in both the United States and Canada. At death, the tax basis is reset to the market value for giving the capital gains tax. Note the contrast here with the Canadian law, but that's just going to affect, again, the details of what's happening in our numerical solutions, and particularly it's going to affect it. It's going to affect only the details, let me highlight, but it is going to, you know, but in particular at advanced ages, because, you know, if you're 90 years old, this reset at death is going to have some effects upon the marginal trade-offs that you make, of course. On the other hand, the tax-deferred account, the treatment is basically the same in the U.S. and Canada. Contributions are based upon labor income. Investment returns are not taxed. Withdrawals are taxed as ordinary income. At death, the retirement account is taxed as ordinary income. Or let me say that the way we model it, at death, the retirement account is taxed as ordinary income. In fact, that actually, at least in the United States context, the last point actually understates some of the value of tax-deferred investing. And I would argue that our solutions actually understate the value of tax-deferred investing because, in fact, and this has really been reaffirmed by the recent adoption of new IRS regulations in this area, there really is significant opportunity for extending the tax deferral well into the next lifetime. Well into the lifetime of one's beneficiary. And so, in fact, actually, the solutions that you'll see in terms describing how valuable tax deferred wealth is, I think, substantially understates the case because we cut it off. We say that the investor, in fact, the investor's estate basically has to settle up on the capital gains tax, and that's actually not how it works. Okay, now, as Jim said, this can be a horrendously complicated problem because to solve this right, you need to be able to address all the risky assets in the investor's portfolio and every possible time at which he could have acquired the assets because that's going to have a distinct tax basis. And so the underlying intertemporal dynamic problem is a horrendously complicated problem with a huge number of state variables. Well, we don't know how to solve that. I don't think the technology is out there to do that. And so what we did, and really I think one of the main methodological contributions in our published paper in the Review of Financial Studies, which let me emphasize didn't have a tax-deferred account per se, was we came up with simplifications to try to make this tractable. And the main simplifications were really the following. First, at the investor's tax basis, we assume to be his average purchase price. Now, in the United States, this is a bit of simplification. And occasionally, we've gotten into arguments with people as to whether it's a good simplification or not. I think the bottom line is that it is a pretty good simplification, even if you can cherry-pick your bases, because it still basically captures, even though it's not what you'd actually do if you could pick which positions to sell, nevertheless, it's still pretty descriptive. It gives you still a pretty good description of what a lot of the key trade-offs are. But in fact, in Canada, this is not really a simplification. This is the actual law. And so, in fact, in our earlier work, we had a very, very nice benchmark in terms of the Canadian law. The second assumption that we make that's important, I think, is the assumption of constant relative with respect to numerical simplification, is the assumption of constant relative risk aversion preferences. Basically, under constant relative risk aversion, the decision rules are simply proportional to wealth. And essentially, then wealth drops out of the problem. And so, what this assumption allows us to do is to view optimal consumption and portfolio decision rules as being independent of wealth. That is, just there's some diffraction. The fraction is going to depend upon the state variables, including age, but wealth isn't relevant for that. Then, to avoid additional state variables for labor income, we assume that it also is proportional to wealth. Now, obviously, that's not a terribly good assumption, and you know, people who are schooled in labor economics sort of recognize that labor income isn't exactly proportional to wealth, and obviously, you know, there's sort of separate risks associated with labor income as opposed to financial wealth. But again, this is sort of, and this is probably the one of all these assumptions. This is frankly is the one that I'm least happy with. But it's again motivated by tractability grounds. So with all those simplifications in mind, oh, and then one more simplification that I didn't state. Initially, we assumed that there's just a single risky asset. So think of it as sort of the overall portfolio. Now we've been able to relax that a bit, and we have a working paper, in fact, where we have two risky assets. The introduction of each additional risky asset, by the way, it needs you to add two more state variables to the problem. So we've been able to get up to two. Risky assets. So the problem with state variables, let me be clear, it's quite different than having just additional decision variables or additional choice variables. The problem with the state variables is if you need a dense grid, let's say you need in each direction of your problem a grid of 100, hypothetically, then to introduce two more state variables means that basically you're solving 10,000 times as many underlying problems. And so now, when we introduced the second state variable, we didn't use a grid of 100, of course. We sort of collapsed back a little bit on that, so we used a grid of about 30. But the point is that basically adding state variables really increases the computational burden dramatically. So for this work, in fact, we only used one. By the way, we do need another state variable to capture the split of wealth between the taxable and the tax-deferred account. So in fact, the problem that we had in the relevant state variables are really three. They're the mix between, there is how much equity within the taxable account, what proportion of it is equity, what proportion of that equity is embedded gains. So in a sense, the way I think about it is what's the basis to price ratio of the investor based upon the current value, what proportion of the investor's overall wealth is held in his retirement account or equivalently in the taxable account. Those are all basically continuous variables, and the solution really depends, the numerical solution depends upon all those. Let me note that the composition of the retirement account itself isn't relevant. And that's actually kind of an interesting point, a very simple point, but an interesting point. What your composition is within your retirement account is irrelevant because since there's no taxes within that retirement account, you can basically freely, and we're assuming zero transactions costs, so you can freely then change the mix within your retirement account. Therefore, what your incoming mix is within your retirement account doesn't influence your optimal portfolio policy. And that's why we don't need to treat that as a state variable. And of course, then the investor's age is also a state variable. So we have basically three continuous state variables in the investor's age. Now, that's basically to sort of set out what is the numerical problem that we're going to solve. Before doing that, however, and before really presenting our dynamic results, I thought it would be instructive to present some non-numerical or analytic conclusions on asset location. And fundamentally, this builds off of the work 20 years ago by Black and Tepper, who used arbitrage analyses to look within the context of corporate defined benefit plans as to what companies should hold. And Black and Tepper concluded that the optimal thing to hold in corporate pension plans was bonds. The argument basically, if the company wants to hold some stock, it's advantageous to hold the stock within the corporate name, and they should hold within the name of the pension plan, where the pension plan wasn't going to pay tax on the buildup. They should hold this heavily taxed stuff called bonds. Then in her MIT thesis, Jennifer Wang applied the Black and Tepper analysis to this question of asset location, and really formalized the Black and Tepper intuition within the context of this location problem, and so we adapt these methods, but in the context of the assumptions that we're making, and so let me sort of focus upon the results and insights then that we get. Now, it's actually kind of interesting to take this sort of analytic perspective, because on the one hand, I think it really helps kind of sort through kind of quickly what some of the key salient sort of issues are. Let me say, to highlight a couple of assumptions that are going to be used within our analytic treatment, we're going to have the rate on capital gains applying both to gains and losses, but be less than the tax rate on dividends and interest. We're going to have unrestricted borrowing, so the investor in his taxable account can borrow without friction. And the final important point, and this really allows us to simplify the exposition for the analytics, is we're going to assume forced realization so that there's not going to be any deferral of capital gains at all. I think this is an important point to highlight, because what that means is that the very important issues that Jim spoke about with respect to pre-liquidation and post-liquidation and sort of lock-in kind of issues, I think they're not, those issues aren't crucial per se to the location conclusions that we reach. They are clearly would be very important for the sort of valuation-related points that Jim was stressing. But I think for the location conclusions, they're robust. Now, you might wonder, well, why is that? Why are those location conclusions robust? Well, fundamentally, the location conclusions are really driven by the observation that equity is lightly taxed compared to bonds. That's the key. And as long as you've got sufficient conditions that equity is lightly taxed compared to bonds, you're fine. Well, then, as long as the if some of the equity return is in the form of capital gains, and capital gains is lightly taxed compared to bond returns, then basically you have the situation that you need. And so the issue doesn't really kind of turn on deferral. And I sort of emphasize this. There's been a little bit of, I think at times, sort of maybe a little bit of confusion about what our paper was sort of saying about deferral. And I think the role of deferral was more that our framework can incorporate deferral in our numerical solutions. We use deferral. But I think the basic insight about location is really quite robust. In fact, one of the things I think that's nice about this analytic perspective is a lot of the sorts of assumptions that I just sort of highlighted a few moments ago, I can sort of throw out the window with respect. I don't need them for these analytic results. So, for example, I don't need to have just one risky asset. You can have 20 different, you can have 100 different risky assets. Doesn't matter how I compute the tax bases. The location point is going to be robust. Form of investor preferences, restrictions on the joint distribution of asset returns, the presence of labor income, how you model labor income, all of that isn't crucial. So what conclusions arise? Well, the main conclusion is that it's optimal for the investor to hold the asset with the highest yield. And that's the bond as long as the bond coupon exceeds the dividend yield. I'm sorry, it's optimal for the investor to hold this within his tax-deferred account and allocate all the other assets to the taxable account. And basically, the idea is, you stuff into the tax-deferred account the asset with the highest yield, because that basically maximizes your tax arbitrage or maximizes your tax shield. And then in personal account, you readjust to give you whatever the optimal exposure is that you want. In fact, if you can, you know, if you're holding now too much bonds because of your, let's say most of your wealth is tax-deferred, and you're holding too much bonds, well, what you do then is you borrow without friction in the taxable account, and you get yourself the right desired exposure. In fact, if equity happened to have a higher yield than bonds, you would hold equity in the tax-deferred account, because our assumption about frictionless borrowing, in effect, then what we're assuming would be that you could short sell frictionlessly, and again, maximize this tax arbitrage. By the way, but let's focus upon the case where the bond coupon has a higher return than dividend yield, which tends to be the realistic case. Then, now here I assume forced realization. In fact, of course, the equity offers an advantage relative to forced realization. Namely, you have the option to defer. You have the option to defer the realization of your capital gains. Well, to the extent that it was already attractive to hold equity in your taxable account, if you're now giving the investor the option to defer, that just reinforces the attractiveness of equity. So all it does is it really reinforces our conclusion that you hold the bond in the tax-deferred account. One other point here that I should highlight is that this is also robust to the natural extension to the Canadian law. The main thing that I've taken away from with respect to these issues, with respect to the Canadian treatment, is that you have a situation where basically bonds are more heavily taxed than equity additionally, because all of the coupon on the bond is taxed, whereas some of the equity is, but that just reinforces the point in terms of this locational preference. Final point with respect to analytics. So one issue which has come up is, well, suppose there's tax-exempt bonds. What then can we say? And the observation's been made by in some of John Chauvin's work and with various collaborators. In fact, in some of the work with Jim and the observation's been made that you may want to hold equity in the tax deferred account, because you might find it attractive to hold tax-exempt bonds in the taxable account. Of course, if you're going to hold tax-exempt bonds, everybody recognizes that you only want to hold them in the taxable account. The tax-exempt bonds don't do you any good in the tax-deferred account where you're not paying tax anyway. So what we argue is that, yeah, there's conditions under which it makes sense to do that, and we work out then the condition within the context of our setting. And one bit of notation I should highlight is that tau sub m here refers to the implicit tax rate on a municipal bond. So even though a municipal bond, of course, you don't own tax on it, there's an implicit tax rate associated with its coupon level. So anyway, under this condition, it can be optimal to invest, in fact, in tax-exempt bonds while holding equity in the tax-deferred account. Now, this can only occur, however, if the tax rate on the capital gains is relatively high. Or another way to say that, it's saying that this happens if the form of equity is quite tax is relatively tax inefficient. But in fact, this condition wouldn't hold for typical parameter values for index funds or tax efficient equity, or even in situations in which the equity is sort of moderately taxed. You need a fair amount of tax on the capital gain in order for this condition to hold. Another way to say this, so in fact, there's some cases where it might make sense to hold equity in a tax deferred account, and in particular, those would be the cases where your equity is relatively active or tax inefficient. But I think that also begs the question a little bit, because it can only be optimal to do this if, in fact, that this active equity is outperforming passive equity by a lot, and we sort of work out a condition for that to be the case. In fact, we interpret that condition as saying that the active equity would have to outperform the passive by about 200 basis points. Now, about 100 basis points, frankly, just reflects the fact that the fees on active equity are a lot greater than the fees on passive equity, and that's about 100 basis points of the number. And then the additional stuff basically comes into play because of the implicit tax cost of mislocating tax-efficient equity. So there's a pretty high, so what we would argue is that there's a pretty high hurdle. So we certainly agree with the conclusion that it may make sense to hold equity within your tax-deferred account if your equity is pretty tax-inefficient. But in fact, then there's the question about, do you really want to hold tax-inefficient equity, and how costly is it to do so? Okay, so let me now turn back to the numerical part of our work, and the final thing I need to do to set that up is to lay out some model parameters. In particular, our numerical solutions are going to be based upon the following parameterization, and let me just kind of go along with some of the parameters I described before. So we're going to assume an interest rate of 6%, that's the rate of return on the bond. We're going to assume a tax rate of 36%, so it's not the maximal tax rate. So in terms of the discussion earlier, it's not the maximal tax rate that we could have justified. A little bit higher than the 31% number that Jim described, but you know, still not really at the upper end of the spectrum in terms of tax rates. We're going to assume a constant dividend yield of 2%, and we've sort of trended to that level in the U.S. in the last couple of years as prices have gone down. The nominal capital gain, we're going to use an expected return of 9% and a volatility of 20%. We're going to tax the realized capital gains at 20%. Now, for the purposes of the numerics, we're going to bar short sales. These returns that I've described to you are assumed to be nominal returns. We're then going to put in an inflation rate of 3.5%. And you might say, well, this is the usual sort of academic model. Why isn't it just a real model? Well, the reason is because of how taxes work with respect to inflation. So to make our calibration sort of have a little bit cleaner interpretation, we put an inflation rate of 3.5%. So these returns that I'm describing, they're actually the nominal returns, not the real returns. So basically, you'd have to adjust for the inflation. We're going to assume a pre-tax, remember I said that labor income was proportional to wealth. We take the coefficient of proportionality to be 0.15. I had to sort of choose something for that. We're going to have the retirement account funded with 20% of the pre-tax labor income. And we're going to have the withdrawals based upon the remaining life expectancy starting at age 65, We sort of just picked age 65. We recognize in the U.S. The mandatory withdrawal started at 70 and a half, but you know that's not. But we picked it at 65. But we also, and 65 is also the age we assumed that the labor income stream simply runs out. So you get 0.15% of your wealth as labor income each period up till 65. Then at 65, this becomes zero. So that's the model set up in the parameters. So what do we learn from our solutions? Well, first, without the ability to borrow, the optimal location involves the following. Investors, the key point is basically investors don't simultaneously hold taxable bonds and tax-deferred equity. You can have either taxable bonds or tax-deferred equity, but not both. So how might you get one of these? Well, you might have a mix of bonds and stocks in the retirement account, but only if you're fully, oh, and this is without the ability to borrow. With the ability to borrow, you simply want your retirement account to be all bonds if you can borrow without friction, as I described before from our analytic results. Now here, so in our numerics, we assume that you can't borrow. So now you might actually have a mix of bonds and stocks in the retirement account, but only if you're maxed out in terms of how much equity you can have in the taxable account. And then it potentially might spill over. And I'll sort of show that. In fact, I'll show that in a moment. You could also get a mix of bonds and stock within the taxable account, but only if your retirement account is all bonds. Now, one of the things that's sort of really neat that arises here is that on an overall basis, your mix of equity, how much equity you have on an overall basis, is actually sensitive to the split of wealth that you have between taxable and tax deferred. A lot of people, a lot of planners think that there's some idealized target portfolio, let's say 60-40 or 70-30, whatever, some split between equity and bonds. And one of the, I think, central insights that emerges from our work is that what your target portfolio is depends upon what's your mix of wealth. If your wealth is mostly tax deferred, you want to be more heavily in bonds. Why? Well, because bonds are a really good deal within the tax deferred account. And at the margin, if that's going to be particularly the marginal place for your bonds, that's going to help drive your behavior. Maybe the most important qualitative insight is to really highlight the role of the mix between taxable and tax-deferred wealth in your asset allocation decision. And so, you know, when I said before that mix was a state variable that influenced the solution, it's not just formally a state variable, but I think there's fundamental economics behind that. In fact, now, in our paper, we have a 3D plot of these relationships, but I thought might be more helpful for our purposes, and then we also have a 2D plot, and I thought it would be helpful for the purpose of the presentation just to focus on the 2D plot. So here what we did was we took two ages, age 35 and 75, and qualitatively the pictures are similar, so maybe we'll just focus upon the upper plot, the age 35 plot. So the middle curve is the proportion of equity that the investor has on an overall basis. The upper curve is the proportion within his taxable account. The bottom curve is the proportion in his tax-deferred account. And basically what you see is that initially the investor has no equity in his tax-deferred account, but as he has more and more of his wealth in his retirement account, what he does is he pushes up the equity within his taxable account. He's got less equity in his taxable account, but he invests it more aggressively because he's looking at his problem on an overall basis. But eventually he maxes out. At the point that he maxes out, he's still holding no bonds within holding no equity within the tax-deferred account. Now, he does not immediately then start to add equity to his tax-deferred account, but rather he waits a bit. So there's actually a region in this plot between about, roughly 30 to maybe 37% in terms of the split, where you literally are 100% equity in your taxable and 100% bonds in your tax-deferred, and where you're not responding at the margin. Now, why is that? Well, the reason is, fundamentally, equity is a much better deal in the taxable account, and it's a much less good deal in the tax-deferred account. So initially, you don't respond because at the margin, it doesn't make sense to respond because the marginal incentives to hold equity are sufficiently different. But eventually, as more and more of your wealth is tax-deferred, you're getting less and less equity. And eventually your mix is getting out of kilter, and you'd really like to get that risk premium after all. Remember, we assumed a risk premium of about 5%. If you back out from our parameters, we assumed a risk premium of about 5%. And so, you know, that's a lot to leave on the table. So eventually you start to pick up equity in the place where it isn't so attractive at the margin, namely in your tax-deferred account.
So basically then, you know, if you look at the overall mix, it's roughly flat, then it declines, and then it becomes flat again. And I think that's an important qualitative feature to stress. Okay, we also present some simulation results from this. I think in the interest of time, we'll skip over that. But our paper has some simulation results. The next substantive point I want to make is that there's a lot of value to tax-deferred investing. And what we then look at is we do a series of plots where we show a couple of points. We show that there's a substantial cost to mislocating your equity exposure. And we do these costs in two ways. One way is by equally, so one of our benchmarks is instead of doing the optimal thing, you hold the same thing in your taxable and tax-deferred accounts, but you jointly optimize so that the split that you're using is the optimal split conditional upon the state variables, but where you're constrained to hold the same split in both taxable and tax-deferred accounts. Then the second benchmark we use is we say, you're a really mixed-up investor, and you get it all backwards. And so you want to put the equity, you misconstrue some of the papers that are out there in the literature, or you maybe misconstrue some of the things that not very sophisticated financial planners tell you, and you think that you're going to invest for the long run in your tax-deferred account, and so therefore you're going to put the equity in there. That's more the level of not all financial planners, let me emphasize, but of a few. So, you know, you could even get it backwards. And in fact, it's not only you could get it backwards, but the aggregate data, as Jim's important work, actually some other of Jim's important work illustrates, in the aggregate, investors do get it a bit backwards. So that'll be kind of a couple of our benchmarks. And then finally, in terms of these valuation benchmarks, we want to look at the shadow price to tax deferred as opposed to taxable wealth. So for example, suppose you have the opportunity to put a significant amount of wealth in tax deferred accounts. I know some folks who have been told that, you know, if they have outside consulting activities, you can actually, you know, and if you're about age 50 or so, plus or minus, you can actually shield about, subject to some caps, you can shield about half your tax of your income, put it in tax deferred account. And you can think of the question as sort of how valuable is it to do that or to forego that sort of opportunity. More generally, you know, people making decisions about whether to contribute, discretionary decisions about contributing, is that a valuable thing to do? So with respect to these issues, we present a sort of a group of plots based upon our baseline parameter values. Main points that emerge here is that these are the percentage, the upper two plots are the percentage utility costs. In the first case, it's based upon the benchmark is equal allocation to taxable and tax-deferred. The middle case, the benchmark is doing things wrong. Obviously, if you do things wrong, these numbers are a lot bigger. There's more cost to doing things wrong than to just being neutral with respect to your stance. The curves are a little bit hump-shaped, you see, because, frankly, if all your wealth is in the tax-deferred account, if all your wealth is in the taxable account, there's not much distortion that can result because we are optimizing after all, and so that's why the costs sort of start out at zero. On the other hand, if most of your wealth is tax deferred, frankly, there's not much cost because you're going to take into account the mix that's appropriate. So where the costs are most is in some intermediate part of the space. Now, of course, the costs are also greater if you're younger. After all, if you've got just a few more years to live, it's not going to be very costly that you get your mix wrong on a lifetime basis because these are really lifetime utility costs. Now, how valuable is it to have extra tax-deferred wealth? Well, sometimes these shadow prices get up to about 3. Now, the trade-off, that is, the extra value of tax-deferred versus taxable wealth can be quite high. How valuable it is really depends upon your age. It also depends upon the mix of wealth between the taxable and the tax-deferred. Why does it depend upon, so it obviously depends upon the length of time. By the way, these are the numbers that I said before understate the case, because these numbers basically at the death, the advantage is gone, but in practice, the advantage really continues during your heir's lifetime. Now, these mixes, as you can see from the plot, if you look at the edge near age 20, for example, the shadow prices are quite a bit higher if you have no wealth or almost no wealth in the tax deferred than if you have a fair bit of wealth. Now, the reason for that is that how valuable it is to have tax deferred wealth is really valuable to you if it's scarce. If it's not so scarce for you, it's not that valuable. Because when it's really valuable is when you're going to use that to optimally place bonds in the account. If you're going to put equity in the account anyway, that limits how valuable it is. It's still valuable, but not as valuable. Okay, so then really the final substantive point that we look at is the issue of liquidity. Now, let me say first at the onset that if you could borrow frictionlessly, liquidity would not be an issue, because the issue of liquidity and changing location would simply go away, because you could then borrow within your taxable account and get to the right thing, and liquidity just wouldn't be a problem, wouldn't affect the locational results. So clearly, for there to be an issue with liquidity, we have to restrict borrowing. So we just bar borrowing, and then we do liquidity analyses in two ways. First, we assume that there's a consumption shock equal to 50% of the investor's wealth at age 30. And in this case, this is a pretty big shock. And to be able to do our numerics and incorporate these sort of shocks, we needed to make some simplifying assumptions. So the main one we make is we sort of do the numerics based upon forced realization rather than the deferral that we used earlier. But now once we do that, we're able to incorporate a lot of other stuff, like we're able to make the contribution decisions endogenous and allow endogenous withdrawals, and we do that assuming a 10% penalty, as is the case in the U.S. Now, what we find then is that for high levels of tax-deferred wealth, and very large shocks, the investor might liquidate his entire taxable account and hedge there before the known shock. And so in terms of the plots, that's this sort of little gaps in here. So here the shock is at age 30, and it's known for sure. So shortly before age 30, the investor does indeed hedge. Now, keep in mind, this is a 50% shock to his wealth, so it's a pretty big consumption shock. But there's a little bit of hedging, at least, that takes place. By the way, some of the hedging that's happening implicitly is really through the contribution decision. So why the investor manages this problem is he says, gee, I'm not going to contribute because I know I'm going to face this issue, and so the contributions kind of disappear. How rapidly they disappear depend upon his age and depend upon how much wealth he has in his tax-deferred account. So notice that the problem is really a problem, you can see in terms of the part of the space where this shows up, the problem is really a problem if the investor's got a lot of tax-deferred wealth. But then the question arises, well, that's a known shock. And maybe a known shock, that's okay for certain things, like maybe you're contemplating buying a house or your child's going to go to college, and so you know when these shocks are going to happen. But a lot of what people have in mind with respect to liquidity shocks are unknown things. So what we did for that was we assumed a 10% probability per period, literally every year, of a 50% shock. And what we find then, and that's sort of more the unforeseen or unanticipated shock, and what we find there is, frankly, doesn't matter at all. That at least that probability of shock isn't sufficiently big that the investor changes his behavior much, because basically the tax costs are really big. And you don't want to, because of the possibility of a 10% shock, even though it's sort of year in and year out, the fact that you don't know that you're going to have that shock, you don't want to give away the tax benefits year in and year out. But on the other hand, you do alter your retirement funding decisions somewhat. And in fact, you get kind of an interesting plot with respect to the retirement decisions and how that's changing over the state space. Well, finally, so I started my talk with a survey. And so what do investors do? Well, in fact, if you look at what they do, they violate our conditions about holding taxable bonds and tax-deferred equity, and the evidence that we cite on this is Jim Perturba's paper with Andy Samwick. It's pretty dramatic, the extent to which investors violate those conditions. And so on an overall basis, you see that investors hold quite a bit more equity within their retirement account relative to their taxable account. And again, that's not in the spirit at all of our conclusions. My final slide simply just references a number of our papers and the associated links, and they deal with different issues involving this sort of broad theme of taking into account the basis and endogenizing these decisions in dynamic context. But in fact, all of these papers are available directly through my webpage. One final comment. One way to sort of think about our framework within the context of the issues raised in Jim's presentation about the role of the tax basis is that our framework, while it's an optimizing framework, is one where there's an explicit cost associated with having a low tax basis, namely that it's difficult for you to realize losses and also rebalance your position. And so our framework potentially is one which can capture the sort of notions of differential value to a basis and try to provide at least one interpretation of what it means for an investor, even though he's actually optimizing and sort of taking a very long horizon perspective of why it might be costly for the investor to have a not very attractive tax basis. Well, I apologize for running a bit over, and maybe we can turn to some questions.
The tax-exempt bond versus the taxable.
I think when I've looked most recently, my sense is that they've continued to have the sort of differentials that they've had in recent years. So it depends very much upon where you are in the maturity spectrum, of course. And I think right now a lot of the tax exempts are perhaps yielding about one. But I hesitate a little bit with respect to exactly what the exact levels of the implied tax rates are. I think a lot of the tax exempts are yielding about one, and the taxables may be yielding about 1.25, 1.5. So there continues to be some differential. Okay, we didn't do that specifically. So the question, I mean, the locational results certainly are going to be, the basic locational point is certainly going to be robust. So the question is, what about the overall mix? Well, obviously, I think if the equity premium stays at the same level, the equity premium stays basically at the same level? Since we don't observe it, I guess that's sort of a degree of freedom. Oh, yeah. I see what you're getting at. So I think the tax cost would, I guess my instinct is, yeah, the tax cost would decline somewhat. Now, there is a kind of a confounding factor with respect to that issue, because it's not only that the level of interest rates is lower, but the steepness of the term structure is so much greater. So the sort of instrument that we have in mind as a bond is a short-term bond. And so one thing you can kind of then argue a lot about is our choice of an interest rate of 6%, which when we started this research program probably wasn't too far off the mark with respect to short-term bond yields, but it's pretty far off now. And so there is this issue in the current context about how to interpret the steepness of the term structure with respect to the choice of rates. Our model doesn't directly contemplate that because remember we only dealt with one risky asset. Now, if we have a second risky asset, we can potentially speak to that. We've in some other work without a retirement account incorporated the second risky asset, although the way we structured the stochastic process for that, it wasn't one with a mean reverting price or mean reverting interest rate, but it was one that's sort of more descriptive of what equity would look like. So we haven't really directly tackled that at this point. Yes, so that's the proportion of the investor's wealth that's in his retirement account as opposed to his taxable account. And we measure this on an after-tax basis. So let me clarify what I mean by that last phrase. So what we've done in measuring that mix is we've actually taken out that. So what we're saying basically is with a 36% tax rate, the U.S. government, or analogously the Canadian government, they own 36% of your retirement account. So what we do is we give them their 36% and we define your mix to be relative to the proportion of your retirement account that you effectively own. That is, you're co-investing their money with them and they don't control the investment mix, but you really only have as an after-tax amount the. And so that's how we're defining the mix over that portion. Right. That's what it is, but I'm defined on an after-tax basis. Oh, okay. Estate taxes. That tax is okay. So how does our analysis relate to estate or death taxes? Well, the view that we took in this paper was that, in fact, all of the investor's wealth at the margin would potentially be subject to those taxes. And so, therefore, with respect to the asset allocation decision, we sort of took the view that it sort of didn't matter. Another way to sort of take to view that is we could alter our bequest, what you're bequeathing, so that what you're bequeathing would only be a proportion of what you have at the end. Now, that certainly would have implications for how rapidly you consumed, particularly as you got older, but that's not going to really affect the locational profile. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about the estate tax, per se, and the reason we abstracted from it, is it really isn't distorting with respect to the locational issue, unlike the reset provision at death, and so that's why we really don't highlight it. Now, in our most recent paper, in fact, the one paper of ours in the tax area that's not on the list of references at the end of the slide, we're now starting to think more seriously about different issues involving estate planning and asset titling and location of things in context in going beyond just the plain vanilla taxable and tax-deferred accounts, and so we're starting to make some headway on some of those kind of more planning sort of issues, and then the estate tax plays a more prominent role. Yeah, and one of the we don't explicitly introduce annuity or insurance vehicles. Well, at least with respect to our numerical solutions, I don't see why that's a problem, because keep in mind that our numerical solutions are done in a state-space context, and so we literally are, with respect to the continuous variables over our grid, solving the problem for every possible, subject to the constraint of working on a discrete grid, we're solving it for every combination. So if, for example, you've got a big lock-in position, or you don't have a big lock-in position, you know, you can just find the appropriate point in our state space. I mean, it is true that with respect to our simulation, which I didn't have a chance to present, with respect to our simulation evidence, I guess that might be viewed as problematic, because that's along a path where you started out at age 20 and you did the optimal thing. Well, when you say over-allocated, I'm not sure I would agree with the terminology over-allocated. I mean, if the investor, most of his wealth is tax-deferred, he's optimally going to have relatively more bonds. That's the efficient thing, and we point out why. The right solution isn't what you would do in a no-tax world. The right solution is in fact, this kind of solutions that our framework is producing. And let me also emphasize that our analysis is done in a state-space context, so then whatever situation the investor starts out from, those define your current state variables, basically, and you make the decision. Then, in effect, we're solving for every possible contingency. We're not just solving for the equilibrium path, but maybe I'm missing. No, and that's not. Okay, should he be 100% in debt? Okay, so, well, it depends. Two scenarios. If he can borrow without friction. Okay, so let's say he can't borrow at all. What? Well, okay, you know, can a real person borrow without friction? What? Me. Okay, fine. So I guess I borrow with a little bit of friction, but my borrowing rate right now is 2.75%. Okay, and I distort my locations this way. I mean, I'm levered in my taxable account, and I own a lot of bonds in my tax deferred account. Now, with respect to what our analysis incorporates, let's take the case without borrowing, So you're not allowed to borrow. Now, in this case, the investor, he doesn't hold 100% bonds because he recognizes that ultimately equity is going to have some value and he wants to pick up that risk premium. But that's exactly the point. If you look at these plots, that's exactly the point that's here. So the only case where we're saying you hold the equity completely in bonds is if you could borrow without friction. But here, as you can see, we are picking up equity exposure because, you know, there is a risk aversion issue. So our framework is, I think robust to that, and I think it's capturing both this effect, and I also think it's capturing this off-equilibrium kind of issue, because basically we're solving a dynamic programming problem for every possible, you know, subject to the grid issues, for every possible combination of the state variables and folding backwards. But Jim, on that point, is the aggregate evidence aggregate evidence still the way it's still the way?
Yes.
So it's still, so the aggregate evidence is still puzzling then. Okay, but that's a very is that in your paper with Dan Bergstresser? Okay, great.